All right, it's a few minutes after, so we're going to go ahead and get started. And what we're going to do, again, my name is Jennifer Renix. I am with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We have a number of people on the telepresser today who are going to offer some very brief statements and then be available for questions. And this is on the very pertinent and real-time topic of coal ash here in the Southeast and the ongoing problems that we are having. Lack of regulations. What we're going to do is go ahead and mute all listener lines right now for just
the conference is now in presentation mode.
First few minutes, and then we will unmute the calls when it is time for the question and answer here. When we go into question and answer mode, I would ask each person to please give their name and the outlet they're from just for tracking purposes on our end. So I am now going to go ahead and turn over this telepress conference to my colleague Joan Walker, also with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, to give us just a little bit of background and introduce our couple of speakers. Joan, are you there and ready to start?
Actually, we're going to start with Emily Feinberg with Waterkeeper Alliance.
Okay. Thank you, Ula. All right, Emily, please take it away.
Thank you, Jen. We're going to get started now, so if everyone could please mute their lines. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Feinberg, and I'm with Waterkeeper Alliance. I'll be facilitating today's telepress conference. We're focusing on the impacts of coal ash pollution throughout the Southeast and opportunities for solutions from state environmental agencies and EPA on the regional and federal level. So we're joined today by the following speakers: Ula Reeves with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, based out of Asheville, North Carolina. They're a regional advocacy organization working on coal ash issues since the Kingston disaster in 2008, spearheading action across the region. Kemp Burdett is the Cape Fear Riverkeeper near Wilmington, North Carolina. The Cape Fear River has been directly impacted by Duke Energy's coal ash, and Kemp is one of the riverkeepers on the front lines of the site. Sarah McCoyn is a resident of Swan Pond near Kingston, Tennessee, and has seen her community drastically changed by the nation's largest coal ash disaster in 2008. Others will be available for comment during the question and answer period. Esther Calhoun with Black Belt Citizens Fighting for Health and Justice in Perry County, Alabama. Nelson Brook, the Black Warrior Riverkeeper in Alabama. Charles Robbins with Cape Fear River Adventures near Wilmington, North Carolina. Frank Holloman with Southern Environmental Law Center based in Chapel Hill office. SELC is currently representing numerous environmental groups. And we have Julie Mayfield, Western North Carolina Alliance. So each speaker will offer brief comments on coal ash and issues in the Southeast while call attendees are in listen-only mode, and then I will open the lines for questions from reporters. So please mute all of your lines. Now I'm going to turn the teleconference over to Ula Reeves with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
Great. Thank you so much, Emily. So we just came from a meeting with EPA Region 4 with the new regional administrator. And we had a very good conversation with Administrator McTier-Tony. She listened to our concerns about regional coal ash issues. She comes from a community background in Mississippi, and we are very hopeful that our conversation with her today will bear fruit. This is a follow-up meeting from one that we had with previous Regional Administrator Gwen Keyes Fleming in late 2012. We have numerous asks that we presented EPA Region 4 with at that time, 18 months ago, and many of those concerns that we have are still not being addressed. We're really looking for leadership from EPA Region 4, and just a few examples of where we feel like we really need leadership is as a final federal rule on coal ash is being finalized by national EPA, we are hoping that Region 4 will represent our concerns here in the Southeast with due diligence. We are one of the most heavily impacted regions in the country with coal ash. We have over 450 impoundments holding 118 billion gallons of ash waste. Many and most of these ash impoundments are unlined in pits that are held back by earthen dams. They are next to our drinking water supplies. We know that they are a threat from a disaster standpoint. We are home in the Southeast to both the largest and the third largest coal ash disasters. The Dan River obviously is the most recent example of a disaster, but we are also all being impacted daily by coal ash as they silently seep out of their earthen dams into our local waterways. They affect our health and our rivers' health. And we feel like there are many, many issues that EPA Region 4 could be working with us on to better address these problems. And I'm happy to go into more of those in the question and answer section. For now, I'll go ahead and turn the speaker, the phone over to Kemp Burdett with Cape Fear River Watch.
Good afternoon. My name is Kemp Burdett. I'm a Cape Fear Riverkeeper, and I'm based out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Just some quick background on Cape Fear River. We're the largest watershed in North Carolina at over 9,300 square miles, and about a fifth of the state's population lives in the basin. And we're one of the most biodiverse areas along the eastern seaboard of the U.S. The Cape Fear Basin is really kind of a microcosm of all of the many issues related to coal ash and coal ash storage across the country. Two facilities impact the Cape Fear River and the people that live within that basin. The first is the Duke Power Cape Fear plant near Moncure, North Carolina. That's located right at the confluence of the Deep and the Hall Rivers where the beginning of the Cape Fear is. And like every other coal ash storage facility in North Carolina, the unlined ponds, five significant hazard coal ash ponds at the Cape Fear plant are leaking and contaminating groundwater. And like every other coal ash storage facility in the state, those ponds are also seeping from the toe of the dam and contaminating surface water with a laundry list of contaminants, including arsenic, boron, selenium, thallium, mercury, lead, cadmium, bromides. Tests show of those seeps show exceedances sometimes hundreds of times higher than safe groundwater or safe surface water standards in North Carolina. Recently, Duke was issued a notice of violation for secretly and illegally dumping 61 million gallons of coal ash wastewater into a tributary to Cape Fear just 2 miles above drinking water intakes for the town of Sanford and above drinking water intakes for over 840,000 downstream consumers of Cape Fear River water. Later, after inspections related to that illegal pumping, cracks were found in the berms surrounding those coal ash ponds. The second plant I want to describe is the Sutton Steam Plant in New Hanover County near Wilmington, just about 30 miles upstream from the Atlantic Ocean, where the Cape Fear enters the Atlantic Ocean. 745 million gallons of coal ash are stored here. And we've got serious groundwater contamination issues at Sutton. Arsenic levels are found at nearly 30 times safe groundwater standards. And these ponds are located less than half a mile away from public drinking water wells operated by the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority. The problem at the Sutton facility is so bad that Duke has had to step in and run alternate water lines from City of Wilmington's treatment plant. But as part of that contractual agreement, Duke also pressured the Public Utility Authority to forever forego drilling for groundwater in a 17 square mile area. That's a huge area to be kind of taken off of the public's access to drinking water. We've also got serious selenium contaminations in Sutton Lake. Serious selenium contamination issues in Sutton Lake. A 2013 study by a noted Wake Forest researcher, Dr. Dennis Limley, found that many of the species in Sutton Lake are seriously contaminated with selenium. One species in particular that the study focused on, he found that 900,000 of these fish each year don't reach maturity because of reproductive issues and other issues related to selenium contamination. We also know that hundreds of people fish in Sutton Lake and take those fish they catch in Sutton Lake home and put those fish on their dinner tables. And that's a real concern of ours as well. We've also seen kind of to wrap it up, failures of the berm at Sutton in 2010 following heavy rains. We saw failures of the berm that holds coal ash back, fortunately, on the back side of the dam. But that's something that points out the probability that these things are going to fail in the future if they're not cleaned up. Thank you.
Thank you, Kemp. Finally, we'll conclude with the open portion of this call with a statement from Sarah McCoyne, resident of Swan Pond, Tennessee, the location of the 2008 Kingston coal ash disaster.
Hi there. Thank you for phoning in for this meeting. I think it's very important. As my story is an old story, and today's news is that it occurred in 2008, and here we are still in a situation where coal ash disasters are still happening, lack of control from the EPA as to regulation is still has not occurred. The states are still regulating coal ash in their own domain, leaving humans in our environment in a very difficult situation. I'm a ninth generation Atkinson family member living on an original portion of our 1,000 acre farm established in the late 1700s. My family chose my community for a variety of reasons, mostly because of the water resources, the richness of the soil, and the beauty. However, since that time, numerous other families have moved in, and we get the question constantly as to why would you continue to live there, or why do you choose to live there? Well, when you look at human nature, it shouldn't matter where you choose to live. Our family's been there for years, yet other families have moved there for a variety of other reasons. The important fact is that we should not have to deal with coal ash in the capacity that we're dealing with today. Yes, TVA did clean up, is still cleaning up, and will continue to clean up our disaster site probably for years to come. Billions of dollars have been spent in the cleanup, and it's imperative that the EPA takes action because it's clearly evident that the states are not. In private enterprise, such as Duke Energy and others, it's slightly different than our TVA pseudo-government situation, where there is some government control. And I just pity the people that reside, whether it be in the Southeast or on the Navajo Nation or up in West Virginia, that they are sitting on coal ash ponds, much like the one in Tennessee, which destroyed our community. I think it's important that the press keep pressure on the subject of coal ash. I understand it's a livelihood for a lot of families in Appalachia. However, the storage of coal ash must be the primary responsibility of the energy entity that is distributing energy, but also storing coal ash in irregular sites, sites that are earth and dam unlined. TVA will likely not make their mistake again. However, it's already proven that other entities, industry entities, have had the same situations that we had, just not at the same capacity. And I'd like to point out to each of you that are listening today a point that I made to the EPA director today, or administrator today, is it's a question that I often ask, and would you enjoy living where I live today? Yes, it's beautiful. TVA is still cleaning it up. If you've never visited the site, it's worthy of visiting. However, you'll have to go back and look at some historical pictures to believe the truth as to what happened 5 years ago in December of 2008. And I think it's very important to recognize that we have only one Earth. We have only one chance at this. And let's get it right for our children and for the sake of future generations.
Thank you to each
presentation mode is now disabled.
Thank you to each of our speakers. We will now open the lines for a question and answer session for the reporters joining us today.
Please do remember we have several other people available here for questions, and I will help direct questions to the appropriate people. If you're with the media and have a question for our speakers, please press star 6 to unmute your line, and please state your name and affiliation along with your question.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, this is Jim Polson at Bloomberg News. I wondered, perhaps this is a question for Ula, could you kind of elaborate on what sorts of regulations need to be in the final set of rules that were not in the proposed rules from several years ago?
Okay, I'll take a shot at that, and I may pass that on to another colleague as well. One of the things that we know that we need to see in the final rules is addressing of legacy sites. So the Dan River facility was a retired coal plant, and we need to make sure that whatever the final rule looks like, it actually gives guidance for how we're dealing not just with active coal-fired facilities and what we're doing with the ash that they are generating on a daily basis, but what are we doing and how do utilities manage ash at sites that are literally just sitting there after the fact? How we are already starting to address in North Carolina concerns about how do we close and move facilities, and I think our final rules need to provide the utilities with some guidance in that direction.
If I could ask a follow-up, there is a group out there, I forget the name of it, I think it's the Coal Combustion Alliance or something like that. There is supposedly a use for the fly ash in concrete and cement, and a use for the bottom ash as aggregate. Why do we have these piles and pits and ponds of stuff, and why isn't this stuff recycled?
Well, this is Ula. There are many streams that are going to recycling in different forms and fashions right now. I may let Frank Holloman speak a little bit to Santee Cooper's plan in South Carolina around recycling. I would just say that one of our concerns with the recycling is that there are still a lack of federal regulations about ensuring the safety of those recycled products themselves.
Hey, this is Frank. One thing we have seen with Santee Cooper is that there are emerging and existing technologies that are now allowing recycling of old ash. That is what Santee Cooper is doing for concrete or cement, as you point out. So I think part of the reason perhaps may be different regional markets. Part of the reason may be the utilities just haven't focused on that. I had a call from a recycler and trying to obtain contacts at utilities, and he said, we couldn't really get in the front door of these utilities because they didn't consider the ash a problem. He said, now you guys have made it a problem and we're able to communicate with them. We just have to find the right person. So I think you will see utilities looking for more appropriate uses. Ula said we always have to be careful they don't just scatter it around the landscape or put it in unlined holes someplace and call that recycling. But it's Andy Cooper, and is the prime example right now. Contracted with several cement and concrete makers, one of which is opening a business next to their facility to make use of the ash for cement.
Okay, and I think Sarah McCoyne has a comment on the recycling issue as well.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to respond to that question. It's an excellent question and a question that many of the residents in Kingston, Tennessee, in our area asked as we were bombarded with the literature that coal ash has secondary recycling uses. So when it was February of 2009, when we still had miles of coal ash 50 feet high spread all over our community, around 300 acres, I specifically asked the question of TVA management as to why, if coal ash is so good, why did we have all the acres of coal ash, over 40 acres, 50 feet high, of coal ash just stored sitting there? And the response I received directly from TVA was that the coal ash in our location, Kingston, Tennessee, was a variety quality in the early 60s, throughout the 70s and the 80s. Different qualities of coal ash was purchased and burned, some better than others, and then when they stored it, it was, as you will, bake a cake, layers and layers of different qualities, and it was not enough of fine quality to be recycled. So then subsequently when we had our coal ash disaster with the cake being smashed and coal ash, layers and layers of different levels of coal ash qualities being scattered all over, of course then 300 acres of coal ash was just a big mosh pit and unable to be used at all. And therefore our friends in Perry County, Alabama were the recipients of this poor quality mosh pit of coal ash.
Questions?
Yeah, this is Manuel with Greenmark. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, well, quick question. I'm wondering if anybody has on the call has any response to Duke yesterday, their update on the coal ash issues and their estimate that it could cost up to $10 billion, they say, to address the impoundments to what many environmentalists think is necessary.
Hey, this is Frank Holloman again, and I've done a little bit of looking at their $10 billion number, and there are a number of problems with it. First, if you look even at their own footnote, they say, well, this is based on ranges of cost. So this is really a sort of back-of-the-envelope estimate by Duke, and really what they're engaging in is a public relations ploy to make it seem as expensive as possible and thereby hope to discourage effective remedy. There are several specific points worth making. When we were fighting Santee Cooper, and Santee Cooper was opposing a cleanup,
right,
came up with a huge number what it would cost to clean up Ranger site, which is only 1.5 million tons. Once we reached the settlement and they agreed, and now they've become supporters and, in fact, enthusiasts for the idea, they're not claiming it's costing anywhere in the range of what they said before when we were fighting. And, in fact, and this is a third important point, the two other major utilities in the Carolinas are doing exactly what we've been asking Duke to do, and it has not affected their rates. They don't contend it will affect their rates. The third point is this. If you look at the numbers, or the fourth point, they are basing a lot of this on their assumptions about one site, Marshall. Marshall is more than one-fifth of the total. Their $10 billion number, as far as I can tell, assumes they're going to move all the ash from Marshall off-site. We don't know that that is needed. A lot of the ash at Marshall is stored in tri-state. We don't know that it has to be moved off-site. Furthermore, the Marshall expenses, and this is key, they go over 30 years. So that number, even with all the exaggerations and the doubts and the estimates and the back-of-the-envelope nature and the public relations nature, it is a number over 30 years. That's not $10 billion in a single year. And it's, as far as I can tell, it's not reduced to present value. So the key issue really is, what would you have to spend every year in terms of just finances? What would you spend on a year-by-year basis to clean these up? The fact that Marshall may be a big problem is no reason not to clean up the other sites, which are much smaller, and which Duke itself has said it could clean up in a time range of 2.5 to 5 years. So I think those are at least at the very outset key issues on that number. The other thing to keep in mind is every major point Duke has made about coal ash so far has proved to be false in the end. Duke told us that they were obeying all laws and regulations. They told us even if they weren't, it wasn't hurting anybody. They told every one of their sites was well maintained and there was no risk of failure. They told us the pipe under Dan River was made of reinforced concrete. It wasn't. Made of corrugated metal. Then they said that was the only place in the state where they had a corrugated metal pipe, and that wasn't true. So we have no reason to accept any significant statement by Duke at face value without a lot of careful examination.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
This is Dave Fluster with the Chattanooga Times Free Press. Can you speak a little why state regulation is inadequate in this area, why EPA has to act? Any of you?
Yes, this is Ula Reeves. I'll take a first shot at that, and I'm sure that there may be some other folks who would like to weigh in as well. One of the concerns that we brought to EPA the first time that we sat down and met with them is that there are a number of what we call NPDES permits. So these are the water permits that coal plants have to have around discharges at the facilities. And because we've seen such a long delay in having a coal ash rule, there have been delays in updating these permits. And so there are some simple things that are on the books that this we feel like EPA could be helping to push states along in terms of just simply enforcing the laws that exist on the books today, updating those permits. EPA has its own what we call the Hanlon memo, which guides states to do the appropriate monitoring requirements as set forth in that memo and so on. So that's one example of where we feel like states are failing to simply enforce existing law. We also feel like EPA could be assisting where we feel that critical data are missing. We have a number of states where groundwater data is simply not available, so we don't have appropriate baselines to determine whether or not we have pollution problems surrounding coal ash impoundments.
And is it your position that you should have dry ash storage of all wet, there should be no wet coal ash storage anywhere? And then how do you feel about capping existing wet ash storage facilities? What's the appropriate remedy there?
So one of the current concerns that we have with capping facilities is that it does not solve the fact that the majority of these impoundments are unlined at the very bottom. So their coal ash is sitting directly on top of soil, which is in many places directly in contact with groundwater or can be very close to groundwater, and that we're also seeing seeps right out into surface water. So getting ash impoundments that are currently wet stored away from our waterways into dry lined landfills is really the best remedy for removing them from our drinking water. And I think that Frank Holloman would also like to add a little point.
I agree with everything Ula said. In addition, I point out we distributed, at least in North Carolina this week, maps that show almost all of these coal ash storage facilities have a stream or a creek running through them. So it's not as though you've got the option even conceivably available. If you did not leak into groundwater, which all of them do, these are not they can be converted to dry storage with a cap because they've got a stream running through them, or a creek, or a spring. And the final point I would make as well is we have a notable example from 2011 of a cap site on Lake Michigan in Wisconsin. It even had a parking lot built on it, and it spontaneously collapsed in Lake Michigan, causing a major spill and tremendous property damage, partially because, according to later investigation, it was a small spring somewhere in the facility. But as Ula says, the problem with capping in place is it does not solve the problem created by storage in these unlined primitive pits next to our waterways. It's for public relations because it covers it up and you don't see it anymore. But the problem is still there, it's still happening.
And for example, on the Dan River site, capping that landfill or capping that impoundment would not have solved the disaster that occurred at that facility, because what we know today is that there were those rusty stormwater pipes that were running underneath the ash impoundment, and they were the reason for that disaster. They collapsed and allowed all of that ash to go out into the river, so capping wouldn't have been the solution.
How would you characterize EPA's lack of the delay in coming up with rules on this issue then? What are the politics of what's happened over the last 5 years?
I think that coal ash has been a very political problem that it's hard to know exactly why we've seen so much delay given the magnitude of the problem. So I think that we feel as a community frustrated by the delay and the fact that we had to actually sue EPA in order to get the deadline. What are the reasons for all of that delay? I guess my best answer is that it has been a political hot potato, and it's been caught up in bureaucratic challenges. Julie?
Yes. This is Julie Mayfield with the Western North Carolina Alliance. We're a group based in Asheville, and I would just add to that that, you know, in addition to pushing on the administrative side for EPA to issue the rule, we've been fighting on the congressional side numerous attempts that of bills that would prohibit EPA from regulating coal ash at all. So we've been fighting this fight on both sides, and I think that confirms what Ula says, is that this is a very political this is a big problem. It is a Region 4 problem, but it is really a national problem. And lots of folks in Congress who would really rather not see it solved and not.
I guess the only thing that I would add here is that coal ash is our country's second largest industrial waste stream. And so I think that because it is such a huge tremendous pressure on EPA and on Congress from the utility companies, particularly the large coal burning companies, who are concerned about the cost and concerned about how how regulation is going to affect their bottom line.
In an election year where the Senate may swing on these kind of issues, is this the time to be pushing for this?
Well, the deadline is December 19th, so it's post-elections.
Okay.
But, they have to come out with a final rule by December 19th, so we've seen too much delay. It has to come out now by that timeline.
Thank you.
This is Jim Paulson at Bloomberg with one more question. There seem to have been fewer of these coal ash spills reported in Europe than here. Is there something that the Europeans do that would be a guide for how it should be done in the United States? Does anybody have a perception on that?
I am looking around our table of very smart coal ash advocates, and I don't think that anybody has a direct point of comparison for international regulations and handling. Sorry.
Thanks.
Hi, folks. This is Chris Holly at the Energy Daily. I had managed to mute myself and couldn't figure out how to unmute myself. So can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
I wanted to talk about EPA, the hint that EPA dropped in its proposed rule on effluent discharge limitations from steam generating units, in which EPA said that because of the stringency of these proposed limits, it likely would not regulate coal ash as a hazardous waste in the rule, final rules that are going to come out at the end of the year. In other words, EPA thinks that the combination of stringent effluent limitation and non-hazardous regulation of coal ash solved the problem. And I wonder if you agree with EPA on this point.
Could you all just put yourselves on mute?
Do you want to pick up one?
Perspective, the ELG rules are very important because at least to the extent the legacy ponds still have water in them, they'll be directly affected even if they aren't covered by the storage rules. So having strong rules is very important. EPA is right about that. But I guess I would be concerned myself about relying on that carrying the whole load, because what we have seen is that the utility is very adept at challenging delay and blunting the impact of regulation, and some of the state agencies are very slow and timid enforcing and putting them in place and enforcing them. So I think from what we have seen, we need every tool and should not count on some combination of other rules that are put in place for different reasons to eliminate the need for a good storage rule.
So if we have more questions, I just want to remind you all that we do have some community members in the room with us.
Hey, folks, I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't make myself clear in my question. Do you have concerns that the coal ash rule will not regulate coal ash as a hazardous waste, as EPA seemed to imply in the preamble of its ELG rule? That was my question.
Yeah.
It seemed to, so.
Okay. This is Ula. I'll give that a shot. I mean, the challenge with that is that we believe that coal ash is hazardous waste. As Kemp said, it's literally ash is chock full of hazardous heavy metals. So by not regulating coal ash as hazardous waste, we feel like that would be doing a disservice to the public and to the environment to ensure that it is truly and properly maintained and held in hazardous waste facilities. Now, we understand that a designation of hazardous waste makes dealing with ash by the utilities a much bigger problem. And I think that that's probably the pressure that EPA is feeling and why they are giving hints and indications that that may be the direction they are going. We will continue as a community and at least my organization to maintain that we believe that coal ash is hazardous for public health and our environment, and we should be treating it as such.
Okay, thanks.
And I think Sarah McCoy would like to weigh in on this.
This is Sarah McCoy, and I live at the Kingston, in the Kingston vicinity, about a mile and a half from where the coal ash disaster occurred.
Yes,
with regard to the hazardous waste question, as well as the storage question, well, it's clear the storage didn't work so well in our area, nor does it work well anywhere else as far as the wet pond is concerned. I sat in numerous meetings, more than I can even imagine, been to D.C. I don't even know how many times, and this issue of hazardous waste is quite intriguing. And I just want to give you an example, and you all can do your research on this. When we were crying as citizens that coal ash indeed was hazardous and now it's scattered all over up and down our rivers, TVA as an entity said, no, it's not hazardous. Even our own state senator and our House representative leaders, those, the ones up in, at the state level and at the national level, you know, selenium, they give it to people in nursing homes, but not necessarily in the doses that we were getting, nor in the fact that the selenium alone was mixed with the rest of the periodic table tossed in. So the part that I want to bring up is that, so this so-called non-hazardous material laying everywhere, once they started scooping it up, you know, you got to do something with it, they put it in trucks first because it was originally going to go on the plateau in Tennessee as opposed to Perry County, and then the rules changed, and Perry County decided they wanted it. At least people in Perry County did. And so they started loading it on train car after train car. I can't even tell you how many cars went to Alabama. I see it every morning, them scooping this wet goo into train cars. It was dripping wet. And at first, they didn't even cover the train cars. So it was blowing. It was seeping all the way down the railroad tracks to our friends in Alabama. And then I noticed on the side of each train car, there was one of those triangles with a number on it. And I took some pictures of it, did some inquiry there. What happens is once the Department of Transportation had this stuff, it's hazardous material, and therefore that's why the code on the side of all the trains had this number. And I wish I could remember the number. I apologize for not remembering, but I can visualize it clearly. It had this number, because it is a hazardous material once the Department of Transportation got it. But once it went to the landfill or once it was laying on the ground, it was no longer hazardous. So right here tells you somebody's got it straight, and that's the Department of Transportation. EPA is being pressured by our politicians who are backed by numerous entities, and I was told this directly by more than one politician. My district consists of coal entities, coal workers, and I appreciate that. Appalachia's full of it. And therefore, I cannot go that route of pushing to have this stuff regulated. So in my opinion, it's political, period.
Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, we're going to take some last questions. Does anyone have anything else? All right, if there's no further questions, we'll conclude the telepress conference at this time. Thank you all so much again. Additional questions or media queries, please don't hesitate to contact us through SACE's media line. 865-235-1448.